מלאכים א', פרק זין. ואת ביתו בנה שלמה 13 שנה, והיכל את כל ביתו. So, as Chazal pointed out, this is the pasuk which tells us what was most important to Shlomo, what was less important, his own home, which included the palace of the Malchut and his personal quarters. That he didn't even start building until he finished the entire Beit HaMikdash. And then it took him 13 years, as opposed to the 7 years. In other words, he worked much, much more quickly on the complex building of the Beit HaMikdash than he did on the relatively simple building, as we'll see, of his own personal quarters and the quarters of the kingdom, which shows us, as Rashi points out, this is really the Gemara, that this is the man who obviously cares a heck of a lot more, both in terms of the result, in terms of the what comes first, to do the Melech HaShamayim than anything that had to do with himself. Vayiven et beit yar halavanon mea ama arko v'chamishim ama rachbo v'shloshim ama komato. Now this is a rather strange word, beit yar halavanon, the house of the Lebanon forest. We know that Chazal viewed the yar halavanon as also a reference to the Beit HaMikdash. That's clear. And there they say, why was it called Yar HaLevanon? Because Melaben, it cleans the red of the sins of Yisrael, just like we find in the remnants of the Chut HaShani, was Melaben. It was also called a Yar because, as the Gemara tells us, there was a magical forest that, of trees that would actually grow gold. These were lost when the... Of course, in the it also means that it was a place where people could hang gold when they came in, and that was a way in which they were dedicating to the Beit HaMikdash. It was very pretty. And when the Goyim came in, it withered, and HaKadosh Baruch was Osid Lahar Ziro. But here it's clearly not referring to the Beit HaMikdash. Now, even though Lamaisa, we find later on in the Navi, that there's definitely, in the mind of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kavayocho, there is a sense that there's a little bit of too much of a mixture here, because this was built right up near the Beit HaMikdash. Maybe they should have kept things separate. So it could be the Chazal see the remez that the concept of Beit Yar HaLevanon in essence meant to could go over both of these areas. It was a whole campus, really, as we'll see. And the reason Zayin Mufarshim was called the Beit Yar HaLevanon is, first of all, it was constructed with beams of cedar, which makes it similar to a Yar HaLevanon. It's a tremendous number, very similar, interesting, to the way in which they decided to build a city hall here in Yerushalayim, except that they used palm trees instead of cedar. But there was the sense of we're creating a forest instead of a building, and this was one of the reasons that the pillars, each one of them was sort of like a Tolkien-esque kind of building, which was made out of these cedars. But I mean, another simple explanation is that the house itself, as we're going to see, is meant to be an area that's chilled, cool. So they would call a summer house would be the house that was built in the forest. There may even have been, some of the Mefarshim suggest, there may even have been a forest of trees that they called Al-Shem Al-Levanon, because Al-Levanon was the name of the most powerful trees. It's a little bit of a problem because we know that there was a Hakodah not to have anything but the special designed by the Nevi'im rose garden in Yerushalayim, and that other things that might cause rotting vegetation, bad smells, were banned from Yerushalayim. That's why there was no industry within 15 kilometers all around the city. There was not allowed to be any kind of industry that would produce pollution of any kind. They carried this at extreme so that there shouldn't be anything that was decaying, anything in the area at all. So that it's difficult to believe that there was actually a forest that would be a Levanon, but the house was made to feel as if you were living in a cool area in a forest. Now, year two, this is not his home where he lived. We'll see later on the home where he lived. This is a public area, part of the campus. This entire campus was surrounded by also a wall that was similar exactly to the wall that was built around the Chotzer of the Beit HaMikdash. There was a separate, smaller area, which was also encircled by a wall for his own living quarters and the living quarters he had designed for Bat Paron. It doesn't say he built here, but he intended to build one there too. And so this was quite a large bayit, 100 amos long, 50 amos wide, 30 amos high, and it was al arba'a turei amudei arazim. There were 4 rows of the cedar pillars, uchrutot arazim al ha'amudim. And then above the pillars, there were these solid pieces of tree that had been cut directly from the arazim, so that you had above them, you could actually see what it were like. The capitals on these pillars were all of arazim. The safun be'erez mima'al alatzlo. Now, we saw the word safun before as referring to a ceiling. The safun really means that which covers over. And so it's not clear at all. Nobody really knows exactly what this is explaining here. Some understand it to mean that there were actual tzla'ot ala amudim, the same way that we use the word tzla'ot by the Beit HaMikdash. which would mean rooms, because these swords supported the ta'im. And that would be a description of a second story that had 45 rooms. So there were arba'im v'chamisha, chamisha asar hatur. Now, there would be all of these immense rooms. Now, the simplest explanation is actually, the way the Mitzvot understands it, is that these are referring simply to smooth-cut boards that went over the top, so that there were 45 of these long boards that were the lower, that is the ceiling, 15 of which were in each section that had been sectioned off by the Amudim. So in other words, the Amudim, it said that there were four rows. That means that there were three spaces between these Amudim. If we assume... Well, it was decorative and supported, of course. So if we assume that these are referring to the coverings, then that would mean if each one of them, we had separated into three parts, each one of these beams would run along the length of one of the parts. So that means each one of them needed to cover one-third of the 100 amud length. So each one would be 33 and a third in length, would meet at the top of the amud and continue on the next one, and then the next one. If there were 15 of them in each one of these turim, so then that would mean that each one of the width would be three amas and a third. So the three amas and a third by the 15 would cover the 50 amas of the width, and there were 33 amas and a third long to cover the hundred along the three sections that were supported. That's the simplest explanation. It's not talking about rooms, it's talking about the number of, you can get a sense of how wide the ceiling beams or the ceiling planks were. So they were really cut out of very, very large, beautiful trees and made quite an impact. Ushkufim shalosha turim. Now you remember the word shkufim were the way that we referred to the atumim, what we talked about, the chalonei shkufim atumim, which wasn't quite clear what it meant by the Beit HaMikdash. We took the approach of Chazal that it was windows that were opening up towards the outside, wider towards the outside. There's many, many other explanations. So actually the explanation was one-way glass, shkufim atumim, so that you couldn't look inside, but you could look outside. Or there was shakuf from one side, atum from the other. Which is a very modernistic way of... Yeah, sure, why not? They could mirror it in a very careful way. Sure. So it might mean even that. But over here, shikufim, of course, has a double meaning. The mashkof usually means the part that's on top. Obviously, it meant the part that's on top because you are shokef. You're able to look out over it. As a matter of fact, some suggest that the concept of shikufim above a mashkof is similar to the idea that we have today of a peephole. You could see who's there. So the mashkof would be you'd stand above the door where there would be a small opening. You could see you standing at the door as a protection device. You'd be way above the, you wouldn't be attackable, but it was called the mashkof, because that's the place where you would be shokef. Interesting. The other expression, mashkof, is a lashon of hitting again, which is the one that Rashi uses in Chumash. But in any event, this clearly is referring to some type. Mechazeh el mechazeh means you could look right through it. In other words, if you stare through, lachazot is very similar to the word lashkif. Except lashkif is to intently look. Mechazeh is just something that's open up to the outside. So what this would be describing would be the way in which windows and doors were placed all along. This thing was like a wide open, bright, open to sunlight, airy area, which is why it would be called a yar. It was like living in the forest. It was meant to be a pleasant place where you'd come in the hottest of weather, you would hang out there, and as we're going to see, it was a place where the public would come, Sanhedrin would show up, people who wanted to plead their case to the king and ask for special help at something. There were places where they had waiting rooms, and then they would come in to the area where the king would dedicate the time to be Yoshev al Kisei HaMishpat, and this was that special area, which we'll get to. So there were three sets now of these windows, and they faced the other side. All these doors, all these mezuzot, were revu'im shakeh. Revu'im shakeh fits very well with Rashi's approach to the aisle yesterday, where the doors that he was describing were five-part doors, because the upper part of the door made a triangle, and therefore you would need five pieces to cover it. It's two sides, the bottom, and then the two parts on top that met at the top of the triangle, as opposed to the doors of the ulam that were called the foursomes. And over here, these doors and windows were all foursomes, not fivesomes. So we can understand that they were, but that's the simplest explanation. The other explanation, of course, the way the Radak understood chamishit or rivi'it yesterday, was the number of moldings that were around them, the number of levels in it, as a beauty device. Umo, mechazeh, mechazeh, shalosh pamim. So that each section is what it's referring to, the three sections divided by the four amudim, leaving us, four rows of amudim, leaving us with three sections. So those sections were on either side, filled with light from these doors and windows above them, in groups of three. V'et ulam ha'amudim asa chamishim ama arko, u'shloshim ama rachbo. Now here too, just like there was an ulam for the Beit HaMikdash, which was the length of the ulam, was the width of the Beit HaMikdash, so too precisely here. He put an ulam, which was a porch, in front of this area. That was like an opening hall for Hashivut. It was 50 amot long, which of course was along the width of the 50 of the Beit Yar HaLevanon, 30 amot wide, which was, again, in the same direction as the length, so it made the entire length 130. Because again, long is its longest area. It doesn't matter whether it's running north-south or east-west. So its length was against the width of the Beit Yar HaLevanon. The ulam al pneihem, the amudim, the av al pneihem. This ulam was al pneihem, ne means east. So the ulam, somewhere this means that there was another ulam in front of it. But the simple explanation is, the ulam was facing panim, and panim is always towards the east in the Torah. So that means that it's telling us the direction in which the entire thing faced. So all of this faced east, and there were an av al pneihem. Av means there was a thick covering that stretched the Lashon of Chazal is called a morish, which are these very large beams, very, very heavy and large, and that gives a support over the top of the ulam so that it was, first of all, it looked powerful, secondly, it was solid. The ulam ha-kisei, and then there was another portico where the kisei of the melech was, asher yishpot sham, plus an ulam ha-mishpat asa, most learned. These are, after you walk in the first ulam, you enter into this wide, gigantic tree area, so to speak, which is meant to give you a sense of the yard. Behind that, there is a waiting room, which is called the Ulam HaMishpat. In that waiting room, you would have Sanhedrin, or members of Sanhedrin, Baledinim, witnesses, and so on. They would all have their place there. And then when called, they would walk into the Ulam HaKise, where the Melech would actually be Yoshev Bedin, and would take them in as an audience. Now, all of this was Safun Ba'erez Mi'akarka Ad HaKarka, rather strange. Instead of saying from tip to toe, from toe to toe, that's a little bit funny. So Mi'akarka Ad HaKarka is understood by the Targum to mean from the Yisod on one side to the Yisod on the other side, in which case, talk about the flooring. The flooring over here was solid Erez, as opposed to Borosh, things that had been used at Beit HaMikdash, which afterwards were covered with gold. Here wasn't covered with gold. So they used the hardwood Erez flooring. Ubeito Asher Yeshev Sham. Now, his personal home. This had nothing to do with where he would live, but of course, king needs a home too. So his personal home was not in this compound at all. His personal home was in the Chatzar Ha'acheret, the other compound, as opposed to this Chatzar, which is called the large Chatzar, as we'll see later on. And that was all the way in the back, Bibeit La Ulam, after all of these various Ulamot. That's how it seems to be the simplest route. There are other explanations that was included inside, behind the front Ulam. Is so difficult to believe. And it was all made in this same way. It was also built basically with the same type of construction. And by it, Yasela Bat Paro, it doesn't say he made it. It says he planned it. He planned to make a house similar to Bat Paro, the daughter of Shalakach Shlomo, was also built in the same fashion as this ulam. So it was the same idea. It was the same type of construction. We'll see the details of the type of construction later, what size stones they used, what was used for the part that was on the foundation, what was exposed to the eye in a moment. Kol Eila. Now, all of the stones, now we're going to start explaining, for all of these buildings, both compounds, were avanim yekarot. They were extremely heavy stones. Kimidot gazit. Now, there was a standard sized stone, which was called kimidot gazit. These were the stones that were visible. See, later on, there were much larger stones that were used for the foundation. And they were kimidot gazit, as opposed to these stones the Beit HaMikdash, these stones were in fact megorarot b'megira. They were cut with metal saws to give them a very smooth finish. Inside and out, these next words have become an actual expression in modern Hebrew. U'mimasad ad ha-tefachot. U'mimasad ha-tefachot. Everybody's familiar with bank tefachot. That's the bank that gives you the overall covering. It will cover your investment in your house. Of course, it will take away your children and everything else when it comes time to pay, but they cover you. The Tfachot, Rashi suggests, many of the first go along with this, that Tfachot is called Tfachot from the word Tefach. So even though it says af yadi tavcha shamayim, it seems to be put down the heavens over and above it. But Rashi says that's because the common architecture was that the roofing would jut out over the building, a tefach on each side, like the Knesset of this building, and then you have the top which juts out. And that's part of fine architecture, so the roofs, the top, they ended up going tefachot because of that. So then it became a verb, tavcha, so you can actually roof something by putting down a roof on it, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu uses as the way in which the shamayim is over the earth. So it means mimasad adat tefachot would mean from the foundation, lashon yisod, all the way up to the tippy top of the roof, they would use, but only from the foundation. And this was what faced outside as well, michutz. Adat chatzer ha-gedola, every building that was in this compound was built with these kind of stones, but not the actual wall of the chatzer ha-gedola. Because the chatzer ha-gedola was built the way the chatzer was built around the Beit HaMikdash. It used wood to cover every three rows of stone and had the wood that provided it with protection against the elements. Now, umyusad, if we want to talk about the actual foundation, as opposed to from the foundation, mimasad, the miyusad, that which was the foundation itself, those were built out of exceedingly heavy stone, not cut to the size of gazit. That was avanim yikarot. Yikarot does not mean expensive. It means loshen yikar kaved. We use yikar as kavod for the same reason. So there's high gravitas here. It's high gravity. Same idea. These were very, very heavy stones, enormous stones, avanim gedolot. Of course, these stones have come to light in all of the places that Olam Elo built. So in the buildings in Megiddo, Chatzor, places where he built, you could actually see stones of this size. They're enormous stones. Avnei eser amot. Stones are 20 feet long. Solid, one solid stone. These are, absolutely shocking to see. You know, and this was the whole riddle. How the heck did rats work? These things can weigh 40 tons apiece. And they were transported to put into place as one solid stone. And avnei shemone amot. And then there were the smaller ones. Those were only like 15 feet. Again, solid stone. And then un milamala. Now above them, there were still using avanim yikarot, they were heavy, but not like this. They were kemidot gazit, and you would use erez as the covering, as we said before. So maybe they were heavy, but don't confuse it with this. And they were also covered with erez, which of course the foundations were not covered with erez. They were all entirely stone. Around this entire compound was a chatzer ha-gedolah, as opposed to the smaller chatzer that we spoke about before, and that was the chatzer ha-acheret, the other compound. That was the personal compound. This was called the large chatzer, and that was built, Saviv, exactly the same way that we learned yesterday, the chatzer on the Beit HaMikdash. Shlosha turim gazit, three rows of gazit stone, and then another row of krutot arazim, of these solid pieces of cedar. This was true, by the way, you will recall, v'lachatzer Beit HaBnayat, dimit, ulolam habayit. This was true of the chatzer that went all around the Beit HaShem, meaning the Heichal and the Ulam, was also built the same way. And then it came time to build the furniture, so to speak, the kalim that would be used inside of the Beit HaMikdash. It appears that there were expert silversmiths and gold workers in Yisrael. But what they did not have was someone who could handle bronze. So this required casting, and therefore Shlomo sent to Tzor. Now, Tzor, of course, the king of Tzor was Hiram. But Hiram is a sort of common name. As in Hebrew, we also have Achiram, find in the Torah. This is built along the same meaning as Hiram. And very confusingly, Shlomo HaMelech sends messengers to Hiram, and that's clear because the Divrei HaYom even says Beferish. He sent messengers to Hiram, Melech Tzor, and asks him to send an Ish Chacham who knows how to deal with metalwork. There he mentions Kesef Zahav also. Here he doesn't even mention Kesef Zahav. And he takes this man, and the man's name is Hiram. But it's not that Hiram. So it's a Jewish man called Hiram. Maybe there's a lot of confusion here, as we'll see. And there's obviously meant to be a parallel between the worker and Hiram himself, and where the worker comes from, and the city of Tzur, which is connected to the city of Tser in Naphtali, just coincidentally, which is where his father was from. So the whole thing is very, very strange. It's meant to be some type of play. And we know, of course, that the play, according to Chazal, goes all the way back to Yehuda and his connection at the time when he left his brothers. He went down to make a shutras with another guy, but also had to do with this whole story, which is why the Beit HaMikdash ends up needing Hiram from Tzor. And so, okay, here we come finally, Ad Adulam, and this is his, he goes to the town of Adulam, there he makes a shutvis, and now this same guy suddenly pops up again as if it's a reincarnation. But this fellow was a boy who was a Ben Isha Almanahu, the son of a widow who was from Mate Naphtali. Now that meant that his father was from Naphtali. The Aviv Ish Tzori. Now, Ish Tzori could be a important man in Tzor, but it's hard to believe that in Naphtali he was an important man from Tzor, especially since in Naphtali, specifically, and the Gemara goes into this, Megillah, the city of Tzor was Choshev as one of the cities, which Ish Tzori would be the way that you'd be referred to somebody from Tzor of Naphtali. So here he is, his father is somebody from Tzor of Naphtali, very possibly. He's living in Tzor with the same name as the Melech of Tzor, who Shlomo sends, brings him down, and he is the son of an almana, which is meant to imply that he didn't get any of these talents from his father. He got it from his mother. But that's because his mother is identified in Divrei Hayomim as having come, amazingly, min benot dam. Why is that amazingly? Well, because if you remember when Bezalel was appointed, and he of course was from Yehuda, that wasn't good enough. We needed also to have another gentleman from Dan. And that way Dan and Yehuda always participate together. This is a tremendous mystery, but there's hundreds and hundreds of elections and places where anything that's done by Yehuda has to be done by Dan. And the first place in which it becomes very, very clear is that he shows up together with Bezalel. So here we have now Shlomo from Yehuda, together with somebody from Dan, who's inheriting these fantastic talents. We're soon going to see the same lashon that is used by the story of Bezalel. And V'yamalei et his father was a Choresh Lachoshet. His father's his story. He is a Choresh Lachoshet. V'yamalei et hachochma v'et hatvuna v'et hadat. And he became filled, exactly the same words we're supposed to use to describe the story of Bezalel himself. So that these were the tools that were used, as Chazal puts it, for the creation of the world. This is exactly the Chochma and the Maleot HaBechochma, Tfuna, Bina, and Da'at. And that those are the things that are mentioned in Briyat HaOlam. This is the base of a lot of Midrashim, comparing the building of the Mishkan to Briyat HaOlam and comparing the building of the Migdash to Briyat HaOlam. So La'asot Kol Melacha B'Nechoshet. And he imported him specifically to be able to do what he needed to be done utilizing bronze. V'yavo HaMelech Shlomo. And indeed he came to Shlomo and V'yas et Kol Melachto. And he did all of the things that he needed to do utilizing the bronze. Now, in Lashon HaKodesh, Nechoshet refers both to actual raw copper and to the mixtures that are much stronger, and that was the bronze. You don't find different words for them. So this is very similar to the pasuk that we find, actually, in Kitisa. V'edaber Hashem Moshe l'imor, Re'ei karati b'shem Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur l'mate Yehuda, ve'amalei oto ruach Elohim b'chochma u'b'tfuna u'b'dad u'b'chol melacha. So here too we have the master builder of Shlomo, who's being helped now with Dan. As Basi just pointed out, we have the special secrets that were kept by those who knew about casting bronze. And this was a tremendous act of technological prowess at the time. And what he did for Shlomo is he was vayotzar et shnei ha'amudim nechoshet. Now the word vayotzar is not a word that is usually used for metalwork. You usually use yitzika. Vayotzar, the yotzer, are the clay workers, the ones who fire clay. Those are the yotzrim, they're called. The reason that here it's called Vayatzar is because he first needed to build the mold. So the first thing he did was indeed Vayatzar. Later on, it'll talk about the Yitzika. So Vayatzar, Shnei Amudim, Nechoshet, the massive Amudim, which were going to stand in front of the Ulam of the Beit HaMikdash, later on to be called Yachid Ugoaz, he was the one who made them. Shmone Esre Amma, 18 Amot High, was the Komata Amud Echad. And the circumference, Chut Shtemesre Amma Yasovet Amud Hasheni. This is one of the Midot Shatorah Nidreshet Bo. In the 32 midot, it's the 19th midah, which is you give an explanation of pairs by dealing with one of the pairs, which is meant to reflect on the other pair. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're switching back and forth, talking about as if there's a difference between the two pairs, but that midah tells you, don't take that as a difference, rather take it as concentrating on one element of one, another element of the other, but both of them are the same. So the circumference was 12 amot. This is massive. Absolutely massive. It was like redwood trees, you know. And this was the second amud. Now, the height that we're talking about was only 18 Amud was only the Amud itself, but then you had the capitals on top of the Amud, which he also had to make. They were quite complex. Ushtei chotarot asa, latet al roshei ha'amudim, mutzak nechosher. Now here it's talking about poured cast of bronze. And these were chamesh amot komata koteret ha'achat, v'chamesh amot komata koteret ha'sheinit. These capitals that were put on top were an additional 5 amot, and they were very decorative. They were made svachim. Svachim is network. Very fine net. We call the covering of the hair of a woman a svacha. So that's a net. And that here, of course, talking about a net that's made out of metal. Metal that was twisted to look like fine little chains. No, not like metal. Yeah, it's very, very delicate. Filigree, And gedilim maaseh sharsharot. Now this gedilim, the word gedilim, is the way you talk about braiding. So a woman is migadelet sara. It means braids, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is migadel. Or Mary Magdalene, which the migadelet sara nashim, from the word migadel. So a hairdresser was called the migadalta. So here too, it would mean it was braided. And these were maaseh sharsharot, twisted metal. Which sort of chains, except chains that are made not of big, heavy links, but rather the metal itself looks like a chain, very soft. L'kotarot asher rosh ha'amudim, and this surrounded now these capitals. Shiv'a l'kotarot ha'achat v'shiv'a l'kotarot ha'sheni. So that's 7 of these designs surrounding the capitals. Vayaz et ha'amudim, and then vayaz over here means to complete them, the detail work, obviously already made the amudim. U'shnei turim saviv al asfacha ha'achas l'chasot et ha'kotarot asher al rosh ha'rim. This is a very complicated sentence, which doesn't really make sense except holistically. There must have been 2 rows, and we'll see there's going to be more detail of it later. There were 200 bronze rimonim, pomegranate shape, that were hanging from this in 2 rows. There's an awful lot of delicate work that was being put into these 5 amot of the kotarot on each side. So that's what it means. The rosha amudim had shnei turim surrounded by these little pomegranates. V'chein asa lo kotaret ha'shenit. V'chotarot asher al rosh ha'amudim ma'aseh shushan ba'olam arba amot. And so, there was also, the way Rashi understands it is, the lower part would flume upwards from the top of the amud. Then you would have this wider area where the svacha was. And then on top, you would also have an inverted flume. And that was a ma'aseh shushan, so it was like a lily. So it looked like a flower facing downwards, so that basically, you would, at the top of the amud, it would curve outwards, creating a belly-like structure, which is actually called that later. So it's an architectural word. We use the belly of it for the fireplace and so on. It was the part that juts out, which would then go back in, coming to the top of the kotera, to the top of the lily. So that was the second koteret, which was Maaseh Shushan, and that was 4 amot. The kotarot al shnei ha'amudim, gam mimal, now this was on the kotarot, but there was also on the actual amudim, so there were also smaller types of crown-like structures. Gam mimal above. It wasn't only this one upside-down shoshan. Milu umat habeten asher le'evra svacha. So the beten here is the part that's jutted out. That was between the two containers, so to speak. That would, one that was facing up and one that was facing down. This is how Rashi understands it.
Not here,
outside in the they all have the same basic type of idea, which it flanges and then there's goes out on top to give it a chashivas on the top of it. And then these rimonim that we're talking about were 200 on each. And here we're going to give the number on the koteret ha'sheni. But again, that's meant to be that midah. So rimonim atayim turim doesn't mean 200 turim. The turim we said before were 2. But the 200 that were placed on the turim that were saviv ala koteret ha'sheni. And that completed it. Vayakim et ha'amudim l'ulam ha'echal. And then he set them up. Vayakim et ha'amud ha'yamini, setting up first the right-hand side amud, and gave it the name of Yachin. And that, of course, is a word that's used for the Beit HaMikdash. Mochon l'shivcha olamim. Heichanti. It's the place that was mimuchan from the beginning for a Beit HaMikdash. So that's Yachin. Also means to stand strongly. That which is a mochon means that it's an institution. It's there. It's meant to stand. V'yakim et amud ha'smali. On the left hand, he put up the other amud. V'yikrat shmo Boaz. And he called its name Boaz, which is the sense of Azut, Uzo Bashachakim, Tnu Oz Lelohim. So the Beis Hamikdash also represents the power and the chutzpah of Yisrael. I never tire of telling that story. It was all in the roots here, where of course Boaz was also the name of Boaz, which has got to have references to what is going on when it's his descendants who are doing this. And this is Ovid and Shlomo. It was the whole vision that everybody had at that moment of Boaz. So this was the story of Meyer Goldberg, a fantastic story of this guy. He grew up in the house of Rav Kook Zatzal. And I don't know what happened, but he sort of went off the derech, went to America, married a non-Jewish woman in Boston, and in the end moved out to the West Coast. And the West Coast, he became very rich, got a big builder. And when I met him, he was already in his late 90s, and he was climbing up on roofs and doing repairs on his own. And all of his business investments at that time were made only after Yi'utz with Malachim. He knew Shas by heart, he knew Zohar by heart. He was absolutely insanely brilliant. You know, he would instantly tell you everything about, you know, your name and how it relates to history, that's Gematria. You remember the kind of things he said. Barnea was, I think you were there when he gave a Bechina on like the most arcane things in Chulin. He's an unbelievable guy. Apparently, who knows? I mean, he spoke to Malachim. I don't know how much, but, you know. They also gave him after. They gave him after on Yom Kippur, I think, in Eretz Yisrael. Every year he was
up. Spoke to us about
Yirat Shamayim. No, there's no question. I just don't know how that related to Yirat Mitzvahs and whatever.
But it touched us deeply.
He was an amazing person. He was an absolutely astonishing person. He would start any page of Gemara, say a word, and he would just continue straight on in the pulpit. So in any event, really not a normal kind of guy. So one time, my shver used to go there every year. He would fly out to Oakland to get a donation for Tulsa Yeshiva. Okay, so he knew him well by this time. So he once went to raise money for my yeshiva. So he goes out we go together, and he walks in talking to Meyer, and he says, Meyer, you know, all this in Yiddish, of course, you live right here, you're on the West Coast, you should be the Amud HaYamini of the yeshiva. So Meyer says, let me ask you something. Yeah. The Amud HaYamini, Shlomo HaMelech calls Yochi. The Amud HaSmoli, he calls Boaz. Now, Boaz was a pretty good guy. How come Boaz was only on the left? I'll tell you, because he married a girl like mine. Once you marry that kind, you can't be the Amud HaYamini. Anyway, on the spot, that was his answer. So, but the truth is this, there is a great deal of truth to that, in that the Yachin indeed represents very, very much the power of the femininity of Rus. Her ability to recreate the makom, to take the family and suddenly put it back together again. Bishar mikomo. It's all about in its place. Very much what we've been talking about all through the past shiurim. And Boaz represents the chutzpah. That's the azut, the wild things. A man threw his entire life out. He had 120 funerals that he had made, as the Gemara puts it. This was like the last moments of his life, in which everything that came out only at that moment. Meitakonis, that everybody thought he was crazy. This business about Hashem Yimachem and bringing in a woman from God knows where at the Klal Yisrael to be making based on that. I mean, all crazy thing, which for centuries there were times against. You know, do we darshan Moaviv, velo Moaviyah, and so on. So there, that combination of right and left is very interesting, because the Medrash also says that the right-hand side, Yachin, is keneged Yareach Yikon Olam, which keneged the moon, which means that it really does stand for femininity. It relates to a lot of psukim that relate Yareach to Konanut. And he was put on the right-hand side. Boaz, okay, but don't get overly Boazy, you know. That becomes the left hand in the story of the Amudim. The Al Rosh Amudim themselves, Ma'aseh Shoshan, so the actual Amudim that the capitals were going to be put on, they themselves were also shaped like the lily. They weren't just flat on top. And on top of that came the detailed capitals that we spoke about earlier. And so, speaking of a Yar HaLevanon, Barnea has just brought in an inscription from Tiglath-Pileser, of course, was also a biblical figure, and he describes his own Beit Yar HaLevanon. And he writes, with long beams of cedar, a product of Lebanon, which are as sweet to smell as the scent of, uses now an Aramaic word, wood. I roofed them, demonstrating appropriate air. Double doors of cedar and pine, which bestow pleasure on those who enter them, and whose fragrance wafts into the heart. So this would be the Beit Yar Lebanon in the vision of Tiglath-Pileser. And now moving on from the Amudim that we've described in such detail, ויעס את הים מוצק עשר באמה משפתו עד שפתו עגול סביב. The next thing that Shlomo HaMelech made was the yam. Now the yam was actually meant to replicate the idea of having the yam in the Beit HaMikdash. We've spoken about the way in which the Beit HaMikdash is the center of the earth, the way that Chazal view it. The actual stone that's there, the Eben HaShtiyah, it's called in the Pasuk the accretion stone. It's the stone around which the actual planet accreted and is ultimately spit out. To the beginning, it was the first anomaly in the gravity that attracted now pieces to that center. And so the Yam is meant to actually to duplicate the idea of the Earth as a water-covered planet. And here it served the purpose, that's what's called the Yam, but here it served the purpose actually of being a mokum that was for the Taharat HaKohanim, and for it was open to the Ama that went through the Beit HaMikdash, which itself was connected to the stream of Ein Itam. So all of it was connected to the earth. The Mayim wasn't Nifsal because it wasn't considered to be in a Kli. And this Yam was an enormous, the size of 150 mikvaot. According to Chazal, if you analyze the number of bat that were in it, maybe we should close the door. And it was constructed out of one solid yitzikah of bronze. And if you analyze it, and there are people that have done the analysis of the weight of the bronze according to the measurements that are given here, and 30 metric tons of bronze was used for making this yam. And you can easily see how when you analyze how large it was. So the yam,
where was it placed?
We're going to say it says Beferish where it was placed. And it was 10 amot radius from one edge to the next, round, agol saviv, 5 amot high, Vikav Shloshim Bama Yisovoto Saviv. And if you took a rope that would go around it, then the circumference of it would be 30 amot. Now, obviously, that's a problem because it isn't 30 amot, it's 31.415 amot, since clearly 3 is not the value of pi. Okay, so this becomes now in the Gemara the source of the idea that halachically you are not needed to be more medayik about anything that needs to be measured than this value of pi to the real value of pi. So if you're dealing with tefillin, then you're dealing with the ibur of a city, which you need to make a round area around the entire city and so on. This is the level of diuk that's required lahalacha. And remember, people tend to forget that the meaning of the measurements in the Torah are always given to Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam. They're given to primitive, without instruments, humans, which is why, of course, we don't pay any attention halachically to the animals that we're constantly swallowing and so on. And they don't exist as far as halach is concerned. Things that we become aware of only later with instrumentation, when we improve our understanding of things. And this is true of all things. So as the Rishonim speak out, it's meant to be Mekuyam in the simplest way, with the most primitive tools. We, of course, as we develop, apply more and more hakpada of technology so that our tefillin are designed to tiny tolerances that would do a jet engine good, but that are not really part of what it is that the halacha requires of the kiyum hamitzvah. However, obviously the Torah doesn't want to lie. So if you look carefully, you will see that the real value of pi is actually listed here in the Pasuk. And that is the k'tiv and the kri of the word. So we pronounce the word for this circumference, kav. Kav is the circle around it, the line around it. But it's written for some strange written reason, v'kava. Not the kav, but the kava. So that implies that the relationship, and here you're going to have to take out your calculators that I asked you to bring, or your phones, so please do that. It means that the relationship of the value given here of pi, which is 3, to the actual value of pi, is the relationship of kava to kav. Now, if you will take the value of kava, which is 111, please put that in your calculator. Okay, so what we have here is the ratio of kava to kav. So take now the numerator, which is 111, kava, divide it by the denominator, which is kav, 106. Divide, please, 111 by 106. That is the value of the proportion with which you need to multiply pi as given. Multiply that by 3, please, and your answer is 3.1415, all for 4 decimal places, the exact value of pi. Astonishing. But it's only beremes, because la halacha, you only need... Insane, isn't it?
What is the kava and
The Torah is giving you the actual value of the relationship to the real pi. It's not going to lie to you when it says v'kav. So it's really that the relationship is these two words, kava over kav, which is 111 over 106. You'll have to multiply the value given 3 by that proportion. That proportion, when it's multiplied, works out exactly the value of pi to 4 decimal places.
This is not my question, so I'm going to ask you a very obvious question. Why not 3?
Because the value given is 3. It's 10 equals 30, which is 3. The radius of 10 is the circumference of 30 in the pasuk, which means that the value of pi given in the pasuk is 3, which is wrong. So the real value of pi needs to be 3, but raised by this proportion of 111 to 106, which happens to equal precisely pi to 4 decimal places. That is absolutely crazy. But okay. Do this at home, yes. Take out your calculators and do this at home.
My last question is, what flavor
do people say? Upekaim, mitachat saviv, ba'ama, bekifin et hayam saviv, shnei torim hapkaim, yitzukim, be'yitzukato. So not only was there the actual general shape of the yam, but there were also these pekaim, which we saw before was the sort of pumpkins or pods and so on. Now, in Divrei Hayomim, it's listed that this was actually were pictures of various animals as well. So, I mean, there may be combinations, maybe, of the, you know, of the two things, so that it would be on the bottom, it would be pekaim, maybe on top. It was, because there it talks about it being a shor. So it could be, it's like those, who's that lady who always paints pumpkins with babies in them? Yeah, Barbanel suggests that these were sort of pumpkins, but with the bodies of Shvarim on top, you know, the head of Ishar. Okay, but there's some combination, obviously, that needs to be made between the story of Divrei Hayomim and the story here. Now, this entire thing was supported on the backs of 12 bronze bull. So it's Omed al Shnei Asar Bakar, Shlosha Ponim Tzafona, Shlosha Ponim Yama, Shloshim Ponim Negba, Shlosha Ponim Mizracha, Vayam Alayhem Lamala. The Yam was supported on them, on top 12, 3 in each direction. If you analyze, the Gemara actually views this pasuk as being Nogea La Alocha. It's from here that we learn that whenever you're turning, that you have to turn in this direction, which is counterclockwise. Because we start with Tzafon, and then we go Yama, and then we go Negba, and then we go Mizracha. So obviously going counterclockwise, which is why when you dance, you're not supposed to dance clockwise, which is the way people usually tend to. But in fact, you're supposed to dance counterclockwise. When the Kohen goes up on the Mizbeach, he's always going around, facing the back towards his right, which is counterclockwise. And that is learned from this pasuk. Yeah, that's it. It's bad luck, and over here, but to us, it's the only way to go. You're actually chayiv in the Beis Hamikdash to go up and then this back, turn right, and continue to go in the direction that this pasuk leads you. The avyo tefach, the actual thickness of this yam, was one tefach. Usvato, the upper lip, was kemase svat kos perach shoshan, just like the cups that are designed in the shape of a lily, where the top of the cup doesn't end, it bends over, flumes over to have this pretty little lip on it, which is thicker, much thicker than the actual body of the cup itself. Here too, it was bent over on top to create a beautiful edge as if it were a cup. And this was the Svat Kos Perach Shoshan, Alpaim Bat Yachil. It contained 2,000 bat, which are 150 times the 40 saw of the mikvah, which is quite significant. If you're talking about 15,000 gallons or so here. Not bad. A lot of water. Now, this water, of course, came directly from the Ein Etam, so it was never needed to be refilled. But yes, it's a lot of water. Ein Etam is a place near the Beit HaMikdash. Well, it's actually Mechlokas, some take it all the way out to Lifta, which is raised above the level of the Beit HaMikdash so that the water flows down into the Beit HaMikdash from there. Again, the water system here is really quite complex because, as you know, you can go all the way out to Hebron, you can see the Yamim that were built, the reservoirs. It flows in the direction of Shulayim, the Beit HaMikdash is raised. So it's not raised above everything else, but it's, as the Gemara says, Bein Ketefav Shachin. It's like a head of the shore.
shore, when the shore is very, very, no, yeah, the water supply. Main ketefaf shofein means that the nicest, choicest part of the shore is between the shoulders, which go up, and then the head is placed between them, so to the Beit HaMikdash, is below the level of Ein Item, which provides the water through the Amma to the Beit HaMikdash and to the Yam. Now we know that in the Beit HaMikdash itself, Moshe Rabbeinu only made one laver, one kior. Now in the Beit HaMikdash, we know that Shlomo multiplied the various kelim. One of the things that he did is that what was the kior actually turned here into 10 mechonot that supported a kior. Now later on in time, in the Beit HaMikdash, the second Beit HaMikdash, what happened was that there was no longer the Yam Shel Shlomo, which was lost, and the Kiyor would become Nifsal. The water in the Kiyor, because it was in a Kli, anything that stays overnight in Beit HaMikdash, Lina, apostles, it can't be used, they would have to refill it every day. So what somebody designed, that was called a Mechona. In the sense that we call something a Mechona, full of all kinds of machinery, that would lower this laver into the ground at night, connect it to the water supply so that it wouldn't become Nifsal, and then it would be raised in the morning. So that was the use of the word Mechona later in time, which meant a machine, not simply a movable device. Here, the Mechonot, it's even a question whether they just looked like machines. It's very interesting because, I mean, if in Yiddish, the word for a car is the machine. So they call it the machine. So here the Mechona was the thing that moved. Question is, did it really move, or only was it only designed to look like it moved? Because it certainly wasn't meant to move. So these kiorim were used mostly, this is in Divrei HaYamim, for the work that was done in the Beit HaMikdash, not for the Kohanim. So this was the water supply that was used to wash off the korbanos and all this, and so on and so forth. Not particularly for Kiddush Yadayim V'Raglayim, which was supplied by the water of the Yam Shel Shlomo. So these, actually, they would refill. But they were made in a design as if they were on a Merkava. So they're even Ramazimir, according to some of the Rishonim, to the Merkava that Shlomo HaMelech would see, that carries now the Ashras HaShchina. This carried the water that would be Matayr and would keep the Beis HaMikdash clean. And so there were 10 of these that were made also out of bronze. Each one was Arba Ba'ama Orech HaMechona HaChat, the Arba Ba'ama Rochoba. It was square on the bottom. There was a length and width. But it was shalosh ba'ama komata. Now what the Mechona itself was a wagon-like device. According to many of the Mefarshim, it wasn't really movable. The wheels were actually yitzika and didn't turn. According to others, depends how we understand so it was a decorative thing, which by the way is very popular today also. For flower pots. And for, they make like something that looks like a wagon, but isn't really a wagon. Yeah, exactly. So that was a remez to the Mechonot in the Beit HaMikdash. And it was 3 amot high. Now, what it actually was a platform that could support the sinks, the kiyor. The sink would be lifted up, placed into this device every day after it was filled. Now, according to some of the Rishonim, particularly the Rabbeinu Hanano, it was a rather complexly designed device that would allow, much as we have now the water dispensers, where you take the container, which is open on top, you turn it upside down, which the first time you do it, feels very funny. You're turning something upside down, and you're thinking all the water's going to pour out. But it doesn't. So it's held in a water container, and then it runs through pipes to be dispensed. According to Rabbeinu Hanano, what we're going to be talking about now is the pipe system that dispenses this water. But everybody understands the Mechona here to be a square device with something on top that held the round bottom of the kior. Kior was turned into this thing, and then the water was dispensed from that point on. By the way, they did found... there were taps. They, according to Rabbeinu Hanano, anyway, they did find this in Cyprus, which is a bronze mechona, the picture of an actual archaeological find. And on top, there was the place for the insertion of the water, which we're going to see is exactly what the square thing that has a round flower-like device on top, and then you put the kior inside of it. So this one moves, but the question of whether obviously, you know, they would roll these things around down the street dispensing water. So that was its use in most places. It doesn't say what the size is, huh? But the amount of water in there was also quite significant. It was 40 baht. I mean, it would be the size of 3 mikvot, a lot of water. And so each of these was shalosh b'amako matara. That doesn't mean that's how big it was after you put in the kiyor. This was the base. In other words, it became the base for the kiyor itself. Now, the way in which these mechonot were designed was as follows. Misgirot lehem. First of all, you have to understand that they were made with a frame. And that was the main point. It was a frame. And that frame supported the parts of the mechona that was in turn going to support the kiyor. Umisgirot bein hashlabim. Now these shlabim, according to Rabbeinu Hananel, he traces this to the word shlaba, which is used in the Gemara in Shabbos, which means a dud of the kiyor, so that it's something that you can turn on, and it provides a nipple providing for the water to come out. So according to him, the shlabim are actual pipes, and they're spread out along this frame. Others learn that the shlabim represent the word shlav, as we would find it in a sulam. The shlavei ha-sulam would be the what we call the rungs on the ladder. They would connect between the frame of the ladder, one half of the frame, to the other half of the frame. So to here, the frame was running horizontally. These shlabim, according to this approach, would go now vertically between the two parts of the frame and would bend as they came on top so that they provided a rounded place to put the kiyor. Actually, there was, we'll see later, that there was a round thing that was put in it first, and in that the kiyor was put. But there was a beautiful base for the kiyor, which was round. But everything else was square. So we're trying to create a base for a round thing with a square device that runs like an agalah, and that's why it's a little bit complicated here. Okay, so according to them, that's all that the shlavim are. You see two very interesting, based on pure language, how you understand that word. Is it ready to shlavar to shiluv, as we would say in modern Hebrew? Shiluv is to draw things together, where they're parallel. There's a shiluv between two things. That's based on, it's a very modern word, but it's based on the sulam, which is shlavei ha-sulam. Here too, the word shalba would be a completely different meaning, and it would be a spigot in English. The al ha-mizgerot, asher ben ha-shlabim. Now, on the actual misgarot, on the frames, there were these beautiful designs of arayot, bakar, ukruvim, and so some suggest this would actually be three completely different levels. That the misgarot, in other words, there was an upper misgarot that were kruvim, a lower misgarot that was the bakar, and then the lowest that was right on the earth over the wheels with the lions. And above the shlabim, there was a cane, mima'al. Now, a cane is exactly what we talk about, the kiyor v'kano. Kiyor v'kano in the Mishkan represented exactly this idea. So there was a kiyor, but there was something under the kiyor that supported the kiyor itself. Here, that which supports the kiyor is the mechona. So similar to the Yamsha Shlomo, where the bakar themselves provide the cane, that would be the kiyor v'kano multiplied 100 times. So too, each one of these kiyors had a mechona, which acted as a cane. And in fact, the word mechona relates to cane, just as mechon l'shiftecha. It's that which it provides a solid backing, solid foundation. So it's a cane. Umitachat la'arayot v'lebakar, beneath all of these designs, were once again luyot ma'ase morad. Now, here again, the simple meaning of luyot is where you have connectors, because it comes from the word livaya. Livaya means to provide a connection to something, an accompaniment to something. And it's always related, fascinatingly, to the idea of human escort. And of course, an escort is usually something to do with the sex trade. And that's because the simple meaning of luyot would be a male piece and a female piece, that they would fit together. But Chazal insists that every time the word luyot is used in the Beit HaMikdash, it actually means coupling humans, which is quite amazing. So wherever we find that was the kruvim that I mentioned before, it means human luyot, so that liviat chen is a charming escort. The luyot in the Beit HaMikdash were there to express the idea of relationship. because that's the whole idea of the Beit HaMikdash, and it was quite explicit in relationship. So all of the, all around the Kiyor, not to mention the pictures that were throughout the Beit HaMikdash itself, as I mentioned in the previous parak, the Goyim viewed this as being completely pornographic. They didn't. This, again, was a reaction in Christianity to reduce the Kruvim to babies in order to pretend to innocence. But in the Beit HaMikdash, there was no holds barred. And therefore, Chazal insists that Luyot is a man and his escort, so to speak. There were four bronze wheels on each one of these. Now, sarnei, that is a strange word. Because, I mean, we know sarnei means, we've seen the word sarnei used for sarnei plishtim, the leaders, the representatives. I mean, one understanding of the word sarnei, which is a more modern understanding that the traditional mefarshim don't have, is that the sarnei represent the thing that everything revolves around. So there would be an axle. It would be an axle of the wheels. According to that shot, these wheels really did turn. It wasn't part of the Yitzika. However, all of the traditional Mefarshim understand Sarnei to be from the word Neser. In other words, aboard. Sarnei or Nisarim. Just with the Otiot confused. Okay, that happens very often. If it was Nisarim, so then it referred to a covering of boards. It wasn't referring to the wheels itself. And these were Sarnei Nechoshet that were made out of solid pieces of Nechoshet. The sides had Ktefot. Ktefot means shoulders. In what sense shoulders? They supported the yam, which implies that from the side there came a piece that bent over on top, curved, to provide the base for inserting the water. And that was mitachat la-kiyor. They would be the ktefot, they would be the shoulders that supported the kiyor from underneath. And these were a ktefot yitzukot me'ever ish luyot. So these, first of all, they were yitzukot. Yitzukot means that they were actually cast, as opposed to the rest that we discussed as pieces that were attached. The parts on the side were cast together with the mizgeret to provide strength. So it wasn't welded or screwed in afterwards. And here too, each one of these ktefot had a picture of ish luyot, zakhar v'nekeva, mitsuyarot, as Rashi puts it. So these were male and female humans. Again, those who try to just stick to the simple meaning of the pshat would imply that it's ish luyot, that there was a place for the insertion of the kiyor into the female receptacles. It was just referring to male and female, of how it would be that these would connect. We talk male and female connectors. It doesn't mean literally that they were humans.
Yeah, what was the point of having humans on it?
Because it's trying to imply that the meaning of the Mishkan is entirely, or the Mikdash is entirely about relationship. That's the point. That's why the Kruvim, as we've spoken many times, the Kruvim are a tikkun of the ego, where there was no relationship. It was just this primitive uba-uba-uba. Right? In other words, it was a worship of the thing. And it wasn't related, there was nothing to relate to. It was one's own expression. The change of that from the mecholot of the ego into the Beit HaMikdash was specifically a male and female, which was a tikkun for the fact that everything about the ego was entirely male. Everything that was being worshipped was male. That was the whole idea of the ego and its friskiness. Everything is a very, very golden youth male image. And it was only worshipped by male. You can't even get a woman to believe in that kind of thing. And it even stripped the women of their earrings and their decorations, which caused afterwards, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to strip Klal Yisrael of the Adoyim, which were the secret of eternal life, and so on. So clearly, it's not a coincidence that this. The Zohar points out that the Shekhinah is never going to be found in a place where there's a bunch of males. It's impossible. It can only be found in a mokka where there's a relationship of Zohar and the Keva, and therefore the Shekhinah appears on the between the Kruvim, only between the Kruvim. It will not appear anywhere else. No, Yishuyot or humans is not talking about the Kruvim here, although it could be, because Chazal see the word Yishuyot as indicative of how the Beit HaMikdash depicted relationship, and therefore defining the Kruvim, it may be they take for granted that it means Kruvim here as well, not just regular male and female. It doesn't say so here. Where do they get it from? This must be... The Gemara takes for granted that Gemara Yishuyot is what the Goyim were making fun of when Ra'u'er Vatah, and that must have been when they saw the Kruvim, but it doesn't say here on the Kruvim. So maybe Bat Nadiv is 100% correct. They're taking for granted that all of the depictions were depictions of Kruvim. But that would mean that the real Kruvim would have to be that way. Upihu. Now the mouth that was going to accept the kior into it, where the water would go into when you flipped the kior over. Pihu, mi beit lakoteret v'mala be'ama. What they did was, is they, even though everything else was square, there was on the top, above the cane itself, there was a koteret that stuck up, an ama, so it was like a crown, upia agol. Now this thing was round, not square. So in the middle of all this square was a round, upia agol ma'aseh chen, it was made like a receptacle, a support receptacle, ama v'chetzi ha'ama, v'gam alpia. Now also they had engravings there as well, Miklaot, these are the pictures of the prachim that we had before, various flowers. By the way, Shoshan, when we talk about Shoshan as a lily, it doesn't only mean lily. There, it refers to the tsura of the flowery part of a flower. So let's say the Gemara could talk about Shoshana Shaveret. I mean, that's weird. Is it a Shoshana or is it a Veret? Which has come to confuse people about Shoshana being a rose. But it isn't the rose. So it means the shape of the flower, of that flowery bending shape which things come out of, which is very clearly evident in the lily. So the Stam lily was the Shoshana, and Shoshana Tamakim and so on. So this extended now up above the top for an Ama and a Chatziyama, the Gamal Piyamiklaot, even though it was round, the mizgeret around it was square, which left, of course, a lot of space for further decorative effects on the top. Now, the four wheels that were mitachat lemizgerot, the yedot ha'afanim, ha'ofanim, b'mechona. Now, here we're talking about various pieces of these wheels, and we're going to get into them, the yad of the ofanim, according to almost everyone who didn't learn seren to mean the axle, is the axle. It's the yad, it's that which goes through the wheels, it supports the wheel. This went through the mechona, the komat ha'ofen ha'achad, each wheel was an ama and a half. Ama v'chetzi ama. Ma'aseh ha'ofanim. Now the way that the ofen was made, was constructed, was k'ma'aseh ofen ha'merkava. That was the way in which, again, al pi kabbalah, and Rashi actually brings this from Targum, it's a reference to the real merkava. Now the real merkava had wheels that could move in alternating directions. It was an ofan betocha ofan. The simple meaning of that is merely that it had an inner wheel, which was connected with spokes to the outer rim. That's all that it would mean. There's an ofan inside of an ofan. So there's two round constructions with pieces going through it. The spokes would connect to an inside wheel. That's the simple meaning. So that would be k'maaseh ha'merkava. Yedotam, so then that would be whatever piece provided the axle. The gabehem, the gabehem, the gav would be the inner wheel that provides the backing, so to speak, for the spokes that go to the outer rim of the wheel. And then you would have the chishukehem, that would be that which is actually touches the ground, which turns, would be the tire, so to speak. The chishureyem, now the chishureyem would be the spokes, or the way the Mefarshim put it, the kanim, the straws that go from the middle wheel to the outside wheel. So this is hakol mutzak. Now, some of hakol mutzak means it was all part of the original casting. Didn't turn, including the yadot. So it was only meant to look as if it would turn. But others learn that's a reference only to the wheel itself. The wheel was casted from solid bronze, even though it looked as if it had been put together the way a wagon or a bicycle wheel would look. But in actuality, the spokes were not inserted as spokes. They really were cast initially in that shape. And then, avar bak tefot, el arba pinot ha-mechona ha-achat, min ha-mechona ketefea. As far as the corner pieces were concerned, the four corners were also cast directly from the mechona, supposed, as we mentioned earlier, supposed to the rest of it. Uberosh ha-mechona, chatzi ha-ama, koma agol saviv, ve'arosh ha-mechona yidotea, u'mizgerotea mimena. On the very top, there was, from the actual mechona itself, besides the design that we had that provided the base for the kior, there was also a half of an ama that was raised above the surface, round, and that was all cast together with it. So it was mimena, the way it's used in the Chumash. Mimena tiye has to come from it itself. Vayifatach al halukot, yidotel, ve'al mizgerotel, And then, as opposed to casting, they actually worked on it with a device to get these things engraved in it to stick out. So they engraved in it the designs of Kruvim, Arayot, Timrot, the fan-like structures, palm-like structures that we've seen before, the design of the Beit HaMikdash, and Kimar, again, Ish Uliyot Saviv. And all around, they had the picture of male and female hugging each other, Chabukim Bizrot Dehem, as Rashi puts it, around the entire design. Mashma, here that it's not the actual Kruvim. Kazot Asa et Eser HaMechonot, this was the design plan for all of the 10 Mechonot. Mutzak Echad, all of them had the same shape, they used the same mold in order to pour the bronze, so that it was exactly the same. Midah Echad, same size. Ketzev Echad, same beat. Lechulana, to all of them. And then, Vayaz Asara Kiorot Nechoshet. Then he made the 10 kiorot that were meant to fit, bronze kiorot that were meant to fit inside of these mechonot. Arba'im bat yachila kiora echad, arba b'yama kiora echad, kiora echad, ala mechona echad, v'esar mechonot. Each one of these kiorim held quite a bit, 40 bat, each kior, 4 amot, and would fit directly into the mechona, one into each of the 10 of the mechonot. Now, what it sounds like it's saying is that as you walked into the Azora, so these 10 mechonot were placed 5 on either side, so that they would be to the one who walked in, either to the north or the south. You walked in the Mizra. However, Chazal say that the meaning of Chamesh miyamin v'chamesh mismolo is referring to the placement of these kiarot that were to the side of the original kiar. I mean, to the left and the right, not to the left of the right of the one who comes in. And this is where they understand all of the meaning in the left and the right of the ribuy hakelim that Shlomo HaMelech made. So he made the additional menorot, as well as he made additional shulchanot, at least in the Bira Yomi. So in every one of these places, which is to the right or to the left, the understanding was that it's to the right and the left of the original, not to the right and the left. Right. And then the etayam natan miketaf habayit hayemanit kedma mimul negev. So here we have a machloket between the Radak, many of the other Pirushim, and Rashi Pirush. So Rashi learns that the word mimul negev is the opposite of mul negev. It means pulled away from the negev, meaning it's very far from the south, and therefore it means in the north. Mul negev would mean against the southern side, because they mean opposite things. But others are not mechalik, and according to them, the Mitzvot learns that it means it was towards the eastern side to the south in the Ezrat HaKohanim. So to the Radak, Natan Hayam Ba'azarad Tzad Darom, Moshuch Klapei Mizrach. Vayas Chirom et HaKiyorot v'tayayim v'ta Mizrakot v'yachal Chiram. This is very strange. First it's Chirom, then it's Chiram. Besides the fact that we've never mentioned his name before, it kept saying Vayas, Vayas, Vayas. Never said Vayas Chirom. Here the Malbim has a remarkable approach, which is really brilliant. If you remember, looking back, we spoke about this in the beginning of the Perek. In Pasuk Yudavid, it says, Ben Yishal Manan, Mimatei Naftali, V'aviv Ish Tzori, and then it says, Choresh Lechoshe, V'yamale Oto, and that's the Chochmah Tvuna in Dat. Now the problem is we mentioned over there, that it mentions Zahav V'chesef in Divrei HaYomim, and here it only talks about Nechoshe, which doesn't seem to make sense. Because, I mean, all of the work over here, which mentions a great deal of Zahav, and not only that, but it mentions Nechoshet that was, as the Gemara in Erechot says, it was Nechoshet Mimurat, which is the word that we'll use over here, means that it was specially processed to be doubly reflective as gold. So it was extremely difficult to make this. And the way the Malbim understands it, he has a klal in general. Whenever something, a name is repeated for no need, it's an indication that it's someone else of the same name. So that he understands that what happened is that there were two completely different shlichim that came from Chiram. And this gets even more complicated because, of course, Chiram is the same name as Chiram. And he tells us that the father was the same name, Chiram, who is, sorry, this one is Chiram, this one is Chiram, which goes all the way back to the original Chira, which was the first person that Yehuda had made his shutafut with back at the beginning in Adullam. In fact, they understand, the Medrash understands that all the way back at the beginning, where the message was sent by Chiram, Melech Tzur, when he heard that David had died, that Shlomo had about to become now the king. So it says over there that he sends this message, how happy he is, and about it, the fact that my good friend David has this son who is able to do such incredible things. But it says in the Lashon, the Pasuk is, Ki ohev haya Hiram le David kol hayamim. It's supposed to be kol hayamim. So according to the Medrash, it means kol hayamim from the days of Yehuda, which makes this man the oldest person in the world. He's certainly older than the fellow, 1,200 years old, according to this. So if he's literally the same person, and then Gemara actually makes that chesed. He's literally the same, but the Medrash makes that chesed. But in any event, Chira becomes Chiron, who sends Chiron, the son of Chiron, to do the work. Now that would mean that the original, the Chiron, the father, subsequently died. And over here, he's sent by Chiron. Not that Shlomo HaMelech sends and calls him, which it says over here. He sent and called him. So therefore, says the Malbim, it all makes perfectly good sense if we understand that initially, it was the father who indeed is mentioned as the one who was a Baki in Zahav and Kesev. He was the one who came, made all the Kalim of Zahav and Kesev. Subsequently, he died. And when he died, so now she's in Yishal Manah. So Shlomo sends for a replacement, knowing that his son is a Baki, but here it mentions only Nechoshet. So what it means over here when it says Vayaz Chirom is because it was the father who was involved in making the Kiorot, the Ya'im, the Mizrakot, and that's because of the way that it was made out of special Nechoshet, not standard Nechoshet. It was Nechoshet Mimurat, which was similar to Zahav. Shnayim Kizahav Lashon, that the Gemara Darshan is there from Divrei Hayomi. Then when it says, continues here, Vayachal Chiram Lasot Kol HaMelacha Asher Asah LaMelech Shlomo Beit Adonai, that's going back now, the son, that's why he repeats his name, somebody else. So the original Kalim had been made by Chiram, and then Chiram continued now to complete all of the Malacha, and it was done. That's the Vayechal, which we find, of course, also in the Mishkan, same Loshon, Vayechal. And Chazal compare it to the Vayechul HaShemayim Va'aretz. It's a reference to now the completion of the Maisa Bereishis. In fact, there's Midrashim that relate Shlomo, Asher Asah LaMelech Shlomo, that Shlomo HaMelech is called Shlomo because he's Mashlim, Maaseh Bereishit, through the Maaseh of the Mishkan. So this is a very, this ties up all of the loose ends. So now this Kalim that are mentioned here, the Kiorot, should not be confused with the Kirot. The Kiorot were actually together with the Ya'im. And in fact, if you take a look at the parallel Pasuk Divrei Hayomim, it says the Sirot, not the Kiorot, which means that it's actually a shovel kind of device that they used for the Mizayach, clean off the Mizayach, so that there was the shovel itself. These were Sirot. And the Ya'im were scrapers, in which they used the scraper to bring all of the dirt to one place and then brought it into the shovel and took it out. And this, of course, is a magic shovel that the Gemara talks about in Erech, and also the Magrefa. These are Magrefot. Ya'im are Magrefot of Nechoshet. So the Magrefa, it says in the Gemara in Erech, was a musical instrument that you were able to utilize the Magrefa to generate 1,000 different notes all the way up the scale. So it was this, and nobody was able to figure out how it was able to do this. They attempted to fix it, no longer was. Whole beautiful story in the Gemara. So that even, and we'll see over here, that the words that are used for the Kalim, simple Kalim, are called Mizamrot, because they are Mizamer. So the idea over here was that the Beis HaMikdash is itself essentially musical. So that even the Kalim that were being used not for music were really musical instruments. And this fits in with the Gemara relates the Yimot HaMashiach to the number of strings that is used on the violin, and the number of strings in Olam Haba changes again. So that it's the scales of music that actually define the differences between Olam Hazeh, Yimot HaMashiach, and Olam Haba. And of course the vision of Shlomo in the Beit HaMikdash was very much that a musical vision. So the Kiorot, the Ya'im, the Mizrakot were the Kalim that were used for Zrika. And then Hiram, the son, completed everything else. It's very nice.
The husband of the Almanah?
He was the husband of the Almanah, so there should be an Isha Almanah. And there it says that Shlomo sent and asked for him, which before he didn't have to do. Hiram had sent him out. So apparently there was a whole Hira, Hiram, Hiraman interrelationship here that was many, many centuries old. And now, just as we did in the Mishkan, we list the Kalim. But you'll notice that Kalim that were made in the Mishkan, no details are given. The only things that we're told about are the kelim that weren't made in the Mishnah. We have all of the details about the Amudim. The Mechonot were never made in the Mishnah. Everything else is understood that this is a continuum from the Mishkan. So it's only the changes that are mentioned. And that's very significant, because if you take a look, this whole idea of the ten, you have the ten Minorot, and the ten Shulchanot, and the ten of the Kiorot. What does it come from? If you analyze the relationship, we spoke about the Gra mentioning before that you have double the size of the Mishkan in length and width.
Exactly.
But you have three times the height of the Mishkan. It's 10 and here it's 30. If you analyze the cubic volume of the Mishkan, according to Rashi's approach, that the Katshe HaKadoshim, the drop ceiling, only was at one thing, then the total volume of the Mikdash was precisely 10 times the volume of the original Mishkan. If you do the mathematics, the Meshech Chochma does the math. So it works out, therefore, that Shlomo filled the volume proratedly. So he needed to add these other kelim, that they should have the same effect for that volume. It's very interesting cheshbon. There's a lot of interesting cheshbonot that are brought. What was the point over here? You know, particularly, for instance, for the menorah. So the menorah had seven kanim, but those seven kanim in his menorah had 70 kanim. But those 70 kanim were connected to the shivim umeis. The seven kanim would only be connected to the umeis that were captured in the Knesset Eretz Yisrael. So it was the Shiva Amimim. This is the Abarbanel points out the interrelationship between them. So all of the mitzvahs of the Torah are essentially linked to this, Yonis and Iverson says, to the Sheva mitzvahs, but they know. That's the sort of all of the mitzvahs. Expand them, and they turn into the entire mitzvah. So that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to, the initial was the vision of the more primal sense of mankind as seven mitzvahs, which was then expanded to include all of the details of the Shiva Amimim.
So the mission wasn't a miniature
Bnei
HaMikdash, the
Bnei
HaMikdash was an expanded mission.
In a sense, yes, it is a big difference. True. The way that one can see that is the fact that the Gemara Darshan's the Atzei Shittim Omdim, to mean that Shema Tomar, that's Avad, Sivram, Batel Sikuyam, that maybe you'll think that they're no longer usable. Talmud Lomar, Atzei Shittim Omdim, Shomdim La'ad Olam Me'alanim. So the Mishkan is buried underneath the Mikdash, but continues to live there, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So that very much expresses the idea that you just mentioned. And then, so all of the things that he had made were the Amudim, Shnayim, that was new. The Gulot HaKot, by the way, these Amudim were so remarkable, you'll note that they were never made again. In other words, in the second Beit HaMikdash, they weren't made. Okay, I understand that Nehemiah couldn't afford to make something like this. But for heaven's sakes, who is the master builder? It was never an attempt to recreate Yochin Ubaat. That shows it was simply totally out of reach. The Gulot HaKotarot, which of course has become in modern Hebrew the absolute tippy top of it. But the Gulot HaKotarot aren't really the absolute tippy top, because the real meaning of the Gulot HaKotarot, the word Gulot, usually refers to a Mayan, Gulot Elit, Gulot Tachtit, that we had by Achsa, the story of Kiryat Sefer. But it means a setting for placing something inside over here. It was like a cup, could be called a Gulot. My cup runneth over would be a Gulot. So that the thing that the Kotarot were put in on the Amudim is called a Gula, but the Sfachot were above that. That whole beautiful piece of the top that was added with all of the detail work, with all of the hundreds of little rimonim hanging them and so on, that was really the tippy top, the beautiful part of the entire idea. So the Gulot HaKotarot, Shorosh Amudim Shtayim, he also made the Sfachot Shtayim, that was the filigree work, L'chasot et Shtei Gulot HaKotarot, Shorosh Amudim, and those were placed over the cup-like device that was formed upward to be able to have the Sfachot rest on them. And then you had a total of the rimonim, 400, because there were 200 for each svacha. So that rimonim are bameot v'shtei ha-svachot. Shnei turim rimonim l'svacha achat. You'll remember that each one of them had two rows of these rimonim hanging on them, and they were there l'chasot et shtei gulot ha-kotarot ha-shel pnei ha-amudim. So they hung down over the svachot to cover the moshav of the svachot on the top of the amudim. And then there were the mechonot aser, and the kiorot asara on the mechonot. And then there was the yam, and then there was the Vakar, which were Shnei Masar Tachat Hayam, the 12 Vakar, which were underneath the sporting of the Yam. All of this was new and didn't have any remnants of the Mishkan. Ve'eta sirot, ve'eta ya'im, ve'eta mizrakot, ve'et kol ha'kilim ha'ela. Now, this is very interesting because ha'ela is spelt ha'ehel, which of course is the ohel. But the ohel is the remnants back to the Mishkan. So indeed, there's a remnant here, which the Targum brings. In the translation, he includes the Kri and the Kif together. So this is all of these kelim as they were found in the original Mishkan that Moshe Rabbeinu had made, were now duplicated and put here into the Mikdash. So it really has a double meaning. These kelim are actually the kelim of the Ohel itself. And then all of them were made. These were the ones that Shirasa Hiram, the Melech Shlomo Beit Anunai, Nechoshet Memurat, according to the Malba, means the father, because these were very complex to make. It's not a typical Nechoshet, according to some. It's a special Nechoshet. The actual Nechoshet itself is a special Nechoshet. Others understand that the polishing Memurat, in Devarim, the word is Nechoshet Maruk, Gemara Darshan, both of them. So some say it means it was a different mix of metals that was very difficult to achieve. It was an alloy of Nechoshet. Others learned that the fashioning of the litisha, the shining of the Nechoshet, was only able to be done by the father. Bikikar hayarden yitzakam hamelech b'ma'avei ha'adama bein sukot u'bein tzaratan. And the place where the king actually had these things made was in a special location that was in the Jordan Valley. Okay, and you were there at the place where they discovered the copper work?
No. But in the alluvial land plain, the perfect work.
Yes, an alluvial land plain. It is indeed perfect for the Koshet. That's exactly what he used. And Sukkot and Tzaratan are currently accessible through Jordan. And what's more, Chazal say beferish in the Yerushalmi that Tar Elah is actually the city of Sukkot. They related to Tar Elah, which is mentioned there in the Torah, and there is a tell, where the Arabic for the tell is Dair Elah. The Dair Elah is very similar to Tar Elah. In Dair Elah, there was an archaeological expedition that found all types of copper remains, different daily use for making copper, ovens, and for melting, and so on. So it's possible that is actually the place where the original work was done by Shlomo.
That's where the Bilam Zevul was
taken. Oh, interesting. So this is Bein Sukkot uBein Tzaratan. Vayanach Shlomo et kol hakelim merov meod meod. And Shlomo put all of these kelim into the Beit HaMikdash. Now, it's as if he made them, just like we found Moshe, even though it was made by Bezalel and Eliyahu, but the entire thing is attributed to Shlomo. And lo nechkar mishkal ha-nechoshet, which is remarkable because the same thing happens in the Mishkan. There's not a hakoda on nechoshet the way there is on the other things, so that the marot, so we don't really know the mishkal, if we include that nechoshet in the Mishkan either. And there's a whole piece in Josephus that, I mean, it's seems absolutely wild that when the number of kelim that he describes, I mean, in the tens of thousands that Shlomo HaMelech had initially made, which apparently was a Kabbalah, that he was Mekabel there. So that this included Vayaz Shlomo et kol hakelim asher beit Adonai, et mizbach hazahav, bet hashulchan asher alav, lechem hapanim zahav. Now this shulchan, the Maisa, here it only mentions the one shulchan. But, once again, in the Reayamim, there were shulchanot. And these shulchanot were also, just like the menorah, tamesh miyamin, the chamesh. Should be small. This means not when you walk into the Heichal, there are five on one side and five on the other side. Because as we know, the nature of the menorah particularly has to be in the Dora. And the nature of the Shulchan has to be in the Tzofan. That's the whole idea of Mishur Tabachim, Yadrim. And it's not just that it should look even. So therefore, as I'll explain it, it means that there was the menorah of Moshe Rabbeinu in the middle, and then there were menorot on either side, five on either side, to the right and the left, and there's a machloket, whether they were actually used, which is similar to the question, I mean, there's in the Gemara, but it was similar to the question of, were these mechonot really mechonot, or did they just look like mechonot? So according to some, they were madlik on all of these menorot. According to others, the actual hadloka only took place on the menorah that Moshe Rabbeinu made. And this was lifnei hadvir, in front of the dvir, which is the mechitza, which was actually covered with the parochet. Remember that the doors didn't close. And all of those things were made from zahav sagur, which was the highest quality gold. The aperach, the anirot, v'melkachai zahav. And this also now includes the menorot, and the prachim and the menorot ad pirchaz, it says the neirot, which doesn't mean what we use it for as a candle. We use them today. Ner means a lamp. So the lamp's the part of the menorah that was actually filled with oil and lit. And you have the melkachayim, which are the little tweezers that are used to fix the ptilot, the wicks. All of that was also made out of zahav. Now, these sipot that are mentioned over here, even though these words are mentioned earlier, ha-sipot, although ha-mezamrot, which Rashi says means exactly what it says, that which makes the music, mezamer, it's a kli that makes music. But the other words were mentioned earlier, mizrakot, kapot, matot. So here, although it's the same words, they're not exactly referring to the same things. here we're talking about zahav, over there we're talking about the mizrakot that were made out of nechoshet, so that they were obviously used for different purposes. Kapot, that we know kafechat m'liha, that was used for the avod of the Torah, so was the machtot. The machtot were shovels that were used to have the gach haleish, v'lakach melo ha-machta gach haleish, m'yalom izbeach, is what the Torah refers to as the type of shovel that can be used for actual coals. V'ha-potot l'daltot. Now Rashi understands potot to be related to petuchot, which would mean here the keys or the locks, the manolim, which in the Gemara are not called manolim, they're called tachat. But others learn that potot is the word that is used for the under part of a swinging door sear.
The cup
that holds the correct. And although it's a little bit strange that they would make it out of gold. So remember that the way that the... It's a hole that is filled with metal that the tzir, which is just a metal piece that goes into it, swivels. So that too was made, at least the ones that were inside, by the Beit Kodesh HaKodeshim. These habatot l'daltot habayit ha-pnimi, the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the daltei habayit l'echal, and that went into the actual echal itself, those were also made out of zahav. They were like little cups. And at that point, v'tishlam kol ha-malacha asher asah ha-melech Shlomo Beit Adonai. That's Lashon of Vatishlam. It's a play on words with Shlomo, as the Medrash points out. He was the one who was Mashlim. He completed everything. And this was a Hashlama, not only of the Mishkan, it was a Hashlama of Maaseh Bereishis, which was waiting for this moment. Vayaveh Shlomo et Kadshei David Aviv et HaKesef, et HaZahav et HaKelim, Natan Biotzarot Beit Adonai. Now this is very strange. He took the gold and the silver that David HaMelech had prepared, together with the Kelim, and put them in the Otzarot. The Otzarot are the story. It's the royal treasury in the Beit HaMikdash, but it's not used. This is astonishing. Why wasn't it used? It is an amazing medrash. And the truth is, if you take a look at this, the way these prokim begin and how they begin with the story of David and David's relationship to Hira, Hiram, Kaltir, Melachzor, and the entire thing is built around that relationship. The last thing that David did was the preparation of all of the money that was needed for the Beit HaMikdash, gave it over to Shlomo, and that's in great detail in Divrei HaYamim. Digging the foundations for the Beit HaMikdash, and that's the whole story of the Shittim that the Gemara talks about. And his entire focus was on preparing the Bayit, and therefore it's called. It's the Bayit of Moav, it's the Bayit of David, Re'e Beit HaDavid is a reference also, not only to the Malchus, but also to the Beit HaMikdash. At the end, it's the same thing. It still goes back to David. Mizmor Shir Chanukat HaBayit to David, despite the fact that he never lived to see that Chanukat HaBayit. It was absolutely remarkable that when somebody puts in that kind of work, that's not what you use to do the work. But it seems almost nasty. So that, well, all this stuff that we didn't need, was all the stuff that David had put together. Okay, I mean, we're not going to throw it in the garbage, but we'll put it into the Otzarot. It's unbelievable. I mean, the Medrash says the most amazing thing, that Shlomo HaMelech refused to use that money. And the reason he refused to use the money is because for the 3 years that there was the Ra'av in the time of David, where it didn't rain that entire period, it was that whole horrible story with the Givonim, and they demanded that Shaul's children be killed, and David refused to use that money to import food for the war. Shlomo said, I'm not going to use that money. If a house is more important than people eating it, it shouldn't be used. It's unbelievable. Is it parallels? Parallels the story in the Gemara when they walk and buy the beautiful shoals. He's saying, take a look at all of these wonderful buildings that were built. And the response was, I wonder how many lives of Almanot and Yitomim were built where all that money was put into these ridiculous edifices. Who needs them? That's exactly what that medrash is referring to over here. And there's another medrash that is a little gentle. And that matter says the reason that Shlomo Melo didn't want to use it was because he knew that the Beit HaMikdash was going to be destroyed. And he felt that the Goyim would attribute the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the fact that their gods had avenged all of the money that David had stolen. Of course, because they viewed him as being, you know, this ganav who would go and just take things from other nations and war against them. So that was always the Ish Milchama, he's an Ish Damim. So he did not want them to have any kind of piton peh that it had something to do with them. But the most awful shot, in a sense, is the ones that the Mefarshim say just as it would be the Pashta meaning. The Pashta meaning would be they didn't need it. In other words, the riboy that is expressed over here, the insane amount of money that was being sent, what it meant was that David HaMelech was essentially living in Mea Shearim. Put together with his whole life, with everybody, put together $100 million to build the Beit HaMikdash. When things grew the way they grew with Shlomo, where $100 million was something that a typical political millionaire would have in your reliance. So as it says, he made the silver was lo nechshav leklum. The gold was like bones. The streets were lined with gold. It became America in its greatest, period of economic siksug. The point over here is, it didn't mean anything, but, okay, it's special because David had set it aside, so we'll keep it sort of as a memorial in the Yom Tzarot.
It's like the first
album. That type of thing. The reason is that, there's a sense of, yes, fantastic development that's associated with it, but there's also a little bit of this sense of, it sounds futile. There's a sense of futility that's attached to it. These are the things that David HaMelech gave his life to, and it turned out we didn't need any of that stuff. And yet, on the other hand, the whole nature of avona, of course, is what you put into it. Is that hachana? Is that care that he put into it? And it turns out that the Beit HaMikdash was built. That's why the Medrash provides these other reasons. The Beit HaMikdash was built out of an immense growth in the economy. It was never done again. Even much, much later, 1,000 years later. Nobody even attempted to rebuild this, although they attempted to add on to the Beit HaMikdash. Used a tremendous amount of gold, but nobody did what it was that Shlomo had done. And there is a sense that what it was that David had done was kept as a sort of the primal makar. In other words, what you did is not that we needed your money. Your money wasn't important. But what you did represented the bayit of David because of his care and because of how much it meant. And therefore, he put these things inside the Otzarot Beit HaShem that they should remain what they were. But we didn't really need them for the actual building. And it happens very often in human life that, one generation will put in a tremendous amount of work in order to... The next generation doesn't even need it because everything changes. And the things that you thought would be so important end up being completely useless. They don't even register. The only thing that registers is the fact that it was so meaningful to you to do. And that, it could be very much, is what's happening here. So here we have the story of the Beit HaMikdash that David HaMelech made, really. Opens, closes with David. Opens and closes with a reference to the relationship between David as Yehuda, the Hiram Melech Tzur, which in and of itself is amazing. A repetition of all of the Kevim of the Mishkan, and an expansion upon them, and a multiplication of them, just as that original money was multiplied. And it gives you very, very much a sense of the continuity, the historical continuity, the way in which this was seen as the culmination of what it was that the door of the Midbar had gone through, what it was they had put out. And to them, take a look at in the Torah, the way that they went around, that they collected those Shkolim, and how each and every one of them meant so much, and one was connected to every individual. And here, there's this unbelievable sense of endless riches, but it's all built on the individuality of the ones who originally counted b'mispar shemot that went to build the first Mishkan that was never Avat Zivram u'Batal Sikuyam.